There's the brain watchers, the automatic self-perpetuating oligarchy. These four, these topics, titles, point to four problems that worry a lot of people today. I want to make some comments on each one, describe the problem, what people are saying about it, what I think about it, and hopefully leave a little time even for you to register your reactions. The organization man. You've all heard the title, the name. William Hollingsworth White, in his book, The Organization Man, came out about 56, 57, made this phrase a part of everyday speech. The general thesis is that the corporation is today molding man in its own image. The corporation is enforcing a dull kind of conformity. Well, my basic reaction to this is that the whole case is overdone. If this were true, I would be very alarmed about it. It's possible that it was much more true in 1956 and 57 when William Hollingsworth White wrote than it is today. I have the suspicion that the book may have done the job, that the book may have succeeded in making enough people sensitive to the danger that the trend was corrected. But I wonder, really, if there ever was such a trend. A lot of people still throw the phrase around. They talk about the organization man. This is the mark of our society. Everybody's becoming an organization man. And, of course, the corporation is supposed to have a large role in creating the organization man, although I think we should remember that other institutions, like churches, do an admirable job of enforcing a certain kind of uniformity and conformity upon their servants. So it's always nice to see somebody like Elmer Witt, who is so impossibly nonconformist. And I'm sure he makes an awful lot of people in the church uncomfortable. But I wonder if we really aren't in danger of straining at gnats and swallowing camels. Looking at the corporation, it is my distinct impression that in the first place, the corporation as an economic, social, political institution has done a great deal to enlarge the freedom of people. And it does this principally by performing its function and performing it well. The corporation is basically an economic institution. And insofar as it is helpful, and it has been very helpful, in providing a wider range of alternatives for people, you know, like automobiles and airplane trips and vacations and all the so-called good things of life, the corporation really does enlarge our freedom. But going beyond that, or coming closer to home, is it really possible for a modern, large corporation to be as tyrannical as a small town or a small business? Is there any tyranny like the tyranny of a small society? It seems to me that one of the things that the corporation does for a man is provide him with a great deal of scope for freedom of expression, a great deal of room to live his own life as he chooses to live it, in return for conformity in relatively trivial matters. I mean, so he wears a gray flannel suit. You know, what was this movie with Robert Morse? It was a stage play. How Did Succeed in Business? Remember, everybody, if you go on a hierarchy, you change your suits. Every person has his slot in the corporation, and he wears an appropriate colored suit. Well, suppose that were true. So what? Is it really a great imposition on individuality and freedom to require that people wear a particular kind of suit? Is a uniform an imposition on one's freedom? It seems to me that a uniform can, if by wearing a uniform you can achieve freedom in the things that really matter, why not wear the uniform? Conformity in trivial matters is a small price to pay for freedom in big matters. I think we all tend to overlook that sometimes. We think that we're going to express and preserve our individuality by refusing to knuckle under to some insignificant little demand that other people make. Very often by giving in, by conforming in small matters, we can preserve and enlarge for ourselves the freedom to do those things which really matter. In any event, this will be my last remark on this topic, what I'm saying in effect is this problem is one I'm not worried about. I've talked to a lot of corporation men, organization men, and at the risk of stepping on some toes, I will assert that I find people who work for corporations to be at least as creative and free, individualistic, as professional men, teachers, lawyers, physicians, and considerably freer and more creative and more sophisticated even than small businessmen, the people who supposedly have escaped from and never knuckled under to the tyranny of the corporations. This has been my personal experience, very unsystematic kind of experience, but I'd be willing to defend this rather vehemently. And the individual, so some of the most bound up, constricted, dull, conforming people I've ever met are the so-called rugged individualists. They're just, you push a button and out comes a certain answer. They talk about rugged individualism, but you really wonder if they have any idea of what individualism means. Them, individualism means lower taxes and weaker labor unions. And that's not a very good basis for individualism. Okay, let me move on now to the second problem, and then I'll pause and you can register your reaction. So I'm saying in effect that one of the so-called ethical social problems that a lot of people worry about when they look at the business community today, the problem of the rise and dominance of the organization man, is a problem which I, after worrying about it and looking at it for some years, decided isn't a serious problem and we might better turn our attention to something else. Like maybe we could turn our attention to the problem of the hidden persuaders. This again is a book title, Vance Packard, who writes well and manages to stir a lot of people up on a lot of different subjects. Vance Packard published The Hidden Persuaders again about 1956, 57. What happened to him, you know, is he was working for Collier's, and the Collier's folded, and he got tossed out on the street, and he didn't want to starve. You know, I cannot dig to beg, I am ashamed. So he turned to writing books, and has done very well at it. Interesting, I've had a chance to meet Vance Packard, spend several days with him, I've known him quite well. You would think, how many of you have read some book by Vance Packard? You'd think that he's a cocky, brash, wouldn't you, from reading his books, know it all. He's got a terrible inferiority complex. He's a little mousy guy. He's as humble and unassuming a person as you would hope to meet. And he really has to get to know you well before he'll open up. In any kind of conversation, he just sits and never talks. And if you ask for his contribution, you'll say, well, I'm really not competent to say anything on this. I'm very interested in what you're saying. Of course, maybe he's gathering material. But the basic thesis of The Hidden Persuaders is that we are being manipulated today. We are being manipulated by advertisers, the hired servants of businessmen. They're making us want what we do not want. They're playing upon our hidden needs, our desire for status and security and desire to be thought virile and all of that. And they're making us buy in huge quantities all kinds of things that we wouldn't buy if the advertisers didn't manipulate us. And in the process, even, they're damaging our psyches. If it weren't for some of the things that advertising tells us about ourselves, we would be happier and freer and all of that. Well, to all of this today, I've got a number of replies. In the first place, it seems to me that we must beware of exaggerating the power of advertising. You can deliver yourself over into bondage by supposing that your taskmaster is more powerful than he really is. There are some things that advertising can do to us, and there are some things that it probably cannot do. Now, there are a few people, no doubt, to whom a good advertising manipulator can do anything. But for the great, great majority of us, advertising may be successful in getting us to shift from Palmolive to Cam-A, but it's not going to be successful in persuading us to be clean. I mean, if we are already people who use soap, it can get us to change our brand of soap. But it won't persuade anyone who is devoted to filth that he ought to be cleanly. We sometimes suppose that advertisers make us buy all kinds of things that we wouldn't otherwise buy, and that's true. But they tend to make us buy a particular brand of the thing that we wouldn't otherwise buy. They don't make us buy aspirin or analgesics, but advertisers cause us to buy Bayer aspirin instead of another aspirin, any other aspirin almost, which is much cheaper and just as effective. As S.I. Hayakawa argued some years ago in discussing the phenomenon of the Edsel, there is a reality principle at work in human affairs, and there's a limit to what you can persuade people to do. If it doesn't make too much difference to them, then the advertiser or the manipulator can persuade them to do one thing rather than another. Hayakawa was discussing the fate of the Edsel. He contended that the fundamental mistake that the Ford Motor Company made was that they ignored the reality principle. The Edsel was the first of these monstrous, big, push-button, chrome-plated, rolling sex symbols. And the idea was to get people to pay $3,000 or more in order to get the kind of thrills and sensations that they could get for, I think at the time, 50 cents from buying Playboy. Now, people will pay 50 cents. It is higher today, I know. I don't know what the current price of Playboy is, but the time is about to turn. 75, okay, thank you. People will pay 50 cents in order to identify themselves with a kind of glamorous world, you know, and they'll read through Playboy as having the Playboy philosophy and you know, being the kind of guy who wears a bunny on his sweatshirt. They won't pay $3,000 for it. The reality principle rules here. When you pay $3,000, you want transportation. Another thing, it seems to me that advertising, whatever its effect, its power over us has been in the past, is becoming less effective and less powerful for several reasons. One is that propaganda cancels out propaganda. You know, we listen to so many claims, and we're manipulated so often that we catch on eventually. My kids, little ones, I say, they watch TV and they say, "Daddy, is that true or is that a commercial?" That's interesting. Is it true or is it a commercial? Then there is associated with this the whole information explosion. People are learning things. Today, people know that an aspirin tablet is 5 grains of acetylsalicylic acid or whatever it is. I mean, you know that an aspirin tablet is pretty much an aspirin tablet, and what differences there are between Bayer aspirin and Macy's aspirin. Probably not as great as the difference in the price of Bayer's aspirin and Macy's aspirin. People know these things. Now, if you think that people are gullible today and are being charmed by the adroit manipulations of all kinds of hucksters and peddlers, my golly, you should read some American history, the history of any country, the snake oil salesman. It's fun to go back into old 19th century newspapers and read the advertisements. Lies, but this stuff worked. You used to be able to sell people the Brooklyn Bridge. It is rarely done effectively today. People just know too much. It's not to say that some people aren't taken in, but I think we exaggerate. Moreover, fewer people are being taken in all the time. And I am encouraged, too, by the fact that the public, or at least the people, the articulate public, is more and more catching on to the diabolical techniques of advertising. A few years ago, you may remember, subliminal advertising was getting quite a play. You found out that you could flash messages on a screen in a movie theater. People would not consciously see them. They were subliminal. But the message would be flashed on the screen so rapidly that you couldn't see it and perceive it. But it was registering in the subconscious. And they experimented with this. And they flashed buy popcorn, buy popcorn, buy popcorn, and found that sales of popcorn jumped spectacular. People didn't know why they did it. They just went out and did it. Now, this is really, I think, diabolical. But the public got quite worried about it, and Congress investigated, and I think there's very little danger that subliminal advertising will be used. This sort of sophistication about techniques encourages me. But on definitely positive side, we must remember that advertising has a function. It is an informative function, which is not to say that all advertising is informative, because most of it, I think, is not. But information has to be gotten out to people if we want to have an effective and socially beneficial competitive economy. If you produce a better mousetrap, the world will not, in fact, beat a path to your door unless the world finds out. And the function of advertising is to get this information out to people. You maybe can't think of any kind of advertising that gets information out to people, but that's perhaps because you don't read the right kind of journals. If you were to read the American Economic Review, for example, you find a lot of advertising in there that is informative. It is informing scholars of books and articles that are available. If you read Business Week, you'll find that many of the advertisements in there are highly informative, informing businessmen about new copying machines. Techniques that are now available, which they can use, and how they can put them to work in their business. These advertisements are frequently very long, many words, and they conclude, "Write us for further information." And they are informative. And there's a lot of this kind of advertising that goes on in specialized trade journals. This is the These advertisements in specialized trade journals are perhaps the best example of what I call informative advertising. I distinguish persuasive or manipulative advertising from informative advertising, and I have no use for persuasive and manipulative advertising. I just as soon it disappeared. The problem, though, is how to get rid of it or how to reduce it. Because if you are in the advertising business, or if you are in some business which has done pretty well through persuasive and manipulative advertising, you won't like what I say. Or also if you're a farmer who's got some empty space that he rents to a billboard company, you won't like what I say. But I've come up for myself with a very simple little scheme. It won't get rid of all persuasive advertising in favor of informational, but it will reduce, I think, significantly the amount of manipulation that goes on in advertising, and, by the way, have some nice incidental side effects. I would do it not by, as some people have suggested, horrible thoughts, setting up a committee to screen all advertising. Just imagine what that would mean and the abuses to which it would lead. But rather, simply ban advertising on certain media. Which media? Those media which are held to be in the public domain. Now, I find three. Television, radio. These are in the public domain. These two are in the public domain because Congress said back in the 1920s that the ether belongs to the people. Science has since proved that there is no ether, but it still belongs to us. And the television channels and radio frequencies are not sold or rented even. They are given to a station to use in the public interest. So we own it, and I think we, the people, through ordinary political processes, would have the right to say, though I have no doubt that we will never say it, that there shall not be advertising on television or radio. Now, that nobody likes because that means that nobody will be there to sponsor Bonanza. But I still think it would be a good idea. I would like to ban all advertising from radio and TV. And then the third area, I would like to ban it from billboards. I'd like to eliminate all outdoor advertising. Again, this is in the public domain. You say, no, sir, farmer owns his field. Well, I say he owns the field. He doesn't own the view from the highway. We do things. We do not permit people to do things which inflict a nuisance upon others. And I think anybody who puts a big billboard up on his property is inflicting a nuisance upon others. Okay, then there are just two other little things that I would do in my practical program for the reform of advertising. I would outlaw telephone solicitations. It isn't. I'm amazed at the fact that legislatures have not done this. It would be very simple to enforce it. You would just impose a heavy fine upon the company and a lesser fine upon the agent. The heavy fine would have to go against the company who solicits the solicitors. Then, if you get a telephone call from a solicitor, all you have to do is find out what product and invite the agent to come out, and when he comes out, the policeman can be there to make the arrest. It's very simple. I use this sort of device myself. I always arrange for them to come out on Sunday afternoon. And because I'm wasting the time in sales, and I come out, and when he comes out, I throw him out of the house. That's not very Christian, but it's the only way I can strike back. Another thing, Mad Magazine had some interesting techniques that you can use. My favorite, which I used before Mad Magazine, was to tell the person who's calling on the phone, say, you sound familiar, do I know you? And then get their name, if you can, and their phone number. And then when you've got, you say, nah, you called me while I was taking a nap. I suppose you take your naps about 2 o'clock in the morning. I'll call you. Bye-bye. One other little item. A lot of people gripe about bulk mail, junk mail, that form of advertising. Here I would simply propose that we charge bulk mail users the full cost and let it go at that. I don't know if that would reduce the amount of junk mail very much, but I just don't happen to feel that junk mail in my mailbox is a serious imposition. It's, usually you go near a wastebasket pretty soon after you empty the mailbox anyhow, so what difference does it make? And frequently, too, it's great stuff for the kids to play with. If you have children, junk mail is very useful. Tell them this is addressed to them, and they will play with it and have fun. So, all right, let me stop there and see what... I'm being rather dogmatic. I'd be particularly interested in your negative reactions to what I've said so far. Yeah.
I have always been very nasty to people in the phone. And I went to church one night and Everybody has a right to their beliefs. And I would like to comment on that. You really gave me that confidence because I, all the time, I'm so nice to everybody, I'm trying to work with people, they can't do that. And he said, they've got a right to do this, and so we should keep the routine.
Well, the statement, everybody has a right to make a living, is a meaningless statement. I mean, who says so? I mean, God gives everyone the right to make a living in any way whatsoever? That isn't true. I don't believe that. Or do you mean the government gives everybody the right to make a living in any way? No, the answer is the government sets limits to ways in which you can make a living. And I'm asking that the government set a limit right here. An argument that I have heard used is that, this provides employment to a lot of crippled people, and women who need money but can't get out of the house and that sort of thing. I don't like that kind of argument. If something is a social evil, I don't believe in hanging on to it and justifying it because it provides benefits for somebody. There are other ways to provide those benefits. I think that I think we should find other ways to provide the benefits. And, matter of fact, I very much doubt, you know, on the basis of, I checked out with one firm that was in the business of organizing these telephone solicitations, find out what percentage of the people really were handicapped. And this company had hired almost no handicapped people. They hired the kind of people who answer the advertisements in magazines, write in for these seeds and get rich quicker, the people who read How to Make a Million in Real Estate. These are the people who tend heavily to go in for telephone solicitation work. It's very low, but then see, it's a very cheap method of reaching people, so that's what counts. One sale will compensate them for 6 days of work by the lady on the telephone. It pays off, otherwise firms wouldn't do it, you can be sure of that.
Yeah.
That's right. And if it isn't outlawed, it's going to grow. It's growing all the time. You get, I don't know how many you get, I get a couple phone calls a week now. And when you just move into a new house, you know, it gets terrible. Or you just have a new baby, or anything that gets your name in the register of public deeds, then it gets horrendous. And sometimes the same company will call you 5 or 6 times because they've got so many different people working the list. And by the way, Bell Telephone, which is a subsidiary of AT&T, you know, the various Bell telephone systems, cooperates enthusiastically with this. They make available special lists for telephone solicitation campaigns. Yeah?
It seems to me that the problem that is outlined somewhat in the organization map is a real one. The lack of spontaneity, creativity, so on. I think I would agree with you that it's not necessarily, the culprit is not necessarily the corporation, but wouldn't you say that this is one of our problems in our day?
Yes, but I suspect it's always been a problem, and I wonder really whether it's any more serious a problem today. I suspect it is less serious a problem today than it was 20 or 30 years ago. I think we are simply more sophisticated, more aware of ourselves and of our nature of what we're doing, more open to diverse possibilities of expression. We move around a great deal too, and that we see the way other people do things. We're continually criticizing our own culture and the traditions in which we were reared.
And I bring you to a good point in a way. Aren't a lot of the books that are written an attack of a basic human problem and then just focusing in a certain way that sounds
Yeah, it sounds very contemporary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I think so. You were next. What kind of social group? You mean the executives, the managers, or a new social group? No, I think they might be somewhat different, but better or worse?
No.
Different.
It's close. Yeah. But they have their own mental problems different than the doctor's problem, or they have better experience because they belong to a corporation, to fly and have to explain that they only have their own mind as well. And I'm not saying better or worse, but this is because they have humiliated themselves too.
I think there's something to what you're saying. Again, I think you can exaggerate this because the whole culture is taking on many of these aspects. It isn't just the wife of the corporation man who leaves the home and goes out and engages in busy work. It's the wife of the university professor too who joins the League of Women Voters, and the pastor's wife who's always running around with the altar guild. And, and the working woman, of course, the big phenomenon is the working woman, the woman who leaves home just to work, because she, not because she needs the money, but because she finds there's enough to do at home. I'm not going to argue with you. Yeah, I tend to agree with what you're saying. What? Well, there are some books you might want to take a look at that have been written on this. One of the very best is Wilbert Moore, The Corporation Man, I think is the title. And Vance Packard has one of his best books, not in the sense it's most interesting, but most informative, is The Pyramid Climbers. It's a real description of the kind of life that corporations make. It's very responsibly done. For that reason, it's somewhat dull, and I don't think it's ever been put in paperback. It's one book that hasn't hit the paperback yet, but it's too responsible. There are some others. A very good book. It goes much beyond this. Book Edward Mason edited, The Corporation in Modern Society. Had some interesting chapters on the corporation in the local community. That book is useful for anyone who wants to understand corporate management. So there are quite a few books. I don't think there's anything that deals specifically with what you're interested in. Oh, there's Individualism and Big Business, too. Leonard Sales edited that. That deals with, I think, some of the things you're interested in. But you have to go to the public library and look under corporation, and you may find in the card catalog, you probably find a lot of things that will develop and explore this theme in which you're interested. And of course, William Hollingsworth White's book is still very very relevant, germane to the question.
I wonder if you have an affinity to Joe, but at the time, Mr. Lucky, friend of merger, more and more bigger and bigger corporation, fewer and fewer smaller. And what you said in the beginning is you don't appear that the individual suffers very much, but particularly by working for a very large corporation. But we may have years ahead that more and more people in our congregation engage in large corporations.
Now, do I have any opinion on that?
Yes, your opinion as the economist or as the pastor looking at the individual?
None as a pastor looking at the individual, because I'm not sure what significance this would have. As an economist, I would say I hate monopoly. I love, not as an economist, partly as an economist, partly as a guy with very definite feelings about how an economy ought to be run. I dislike monopoly. Insofar as mergers promote the growth of monopoly, I'm against them. Insofar as they don't promote it, I'm neutral toward them. I'm not in favor of them. I think it's always, I have a presupposition against merger, against growth by merger. If a corporation wants to grow, I think it ought to grow internally. Grow by doing a more effective competitive job, not by buying up some competitor. So I'm basically hostile toward mergers. I'm of the school of we love the Sherman Act and wish it were part of the Constitution. I do think, however, that most people exaggerate the significance of mergers. They talk about how corporations are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and don't realize that in relationship to the size of the economy and the size of the markets in which they sell, corporations have been getting smaller. Especially in relationship to the size of the market in which they sell, corporations have been getting smaller. And that's the real test. That's what counts. I mean, I don't care what percentage of total assets in New Jersey is owned by somebody or the other, or in Delaware by the DuPont company. It doesn't make any real difference. I don't see what difference it makes anywhere that counts. But what percentage of the total sales in this market is controlled by this firm? That makes a difference, because that confers monopoly power. And I find that this percentage is continually diminishing. Not everywhere, of course, not in all industries, but it's diminishing substantially through a large number of industries. From which I conclude that the economy is getting more competitive, and that makes me happy. But I'm also very much in favor of the present governmental trend to view with an extremely skeptical eye attempts at merger by large businesses. I think that's good. We should be hostile toward mergers. The reasons that businessmen give for mergers are usually pretty bad. They're specious. They have logical holes in them. And when a guy gives a reason for something he wants to do, and his reason is full of holes, then be suspicious. If he can't come up with a good reason, maybe he's got a bad reason. That 3M friend back there. 3M's grown by, it's grown internally. Hasn't it? Mostly, very, very few acquisitions. Good for the government.
More than all the failures put together. So in a way, they may be looking for a straight
type of person that is this individual as a corporation man, yet I think of these all kinds of avenues open for the individual development of the person. So that's what kind of angle you're looking at. You can say it, they're a stereotype person or in essence they're an individual, but you see all types working for a corporation individually as to any other kind of business or area of the time.
Okay, let's go on. Is that right? Well, last time I gave this, I never got around to the automatic self-perpetuating oligarchy. I won't today either, I think. I'd say something about the brain watchers, because this is one that really bothers me. This is a part of a much broader problem. I'm talking here, the brain watchers are those who go in for personality testing, who are trying to find out what kind of person you really are in order that they may fit you in the peg that is ready for you. For them, I mean, fit you, the peg, in the slot that is ready for you. There are a lot of other ways in which people invade our privacy, and I consider personality testing a gross form of privacy invasion. You know all about the electronic bugs and everything else, and of course, the person who knows, you think the person who knows most about you in your community is your wife, you're wrong, it's the local credit bureau. There are things that your wife doesn't know, like how many checks you've bounced, that the credit bureau does. Now, corporations are not the only ones prying into our souls to see whether we are pegs of just the right shape for the destiny that others have in mind for us. Some of the other groups that have been very actively engaged in personality testing include seminaries. Law schools used to do it, but they've by and large given it up. But seminaries are going this route with a vengeance today. It used to be that we didn't know whether a person had a call from the Holy Spirit to enter the ministry. Now we can find out. We give them the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. I expect some Missouri Synod theologian to come along and prove that that's verbally inspired, but that hasn't happened yet. I want to say something about the development of this. The testing began with achievement testing. This goes well back in history. You know, you would test people to see whether they had mastered some body of knowledge or some skill. In schools have always done this kind of thing. Training programs do this. You want to be a plumber, okay, and then you take some courses and then you prove that you can plumb. From this, though, we moved within the lifetime of most of you to measuring not achievement but potential for achievement. The IQ test is the great example here, something you're all familiar with. And everybody got his IQ measured. This is, I want to stress, not measuring achievement, but measuring potential. You know, because we say, gee, look at his IQ, he's an underachiever, or he's an overachiever. I had a professor once who graded not on achievement nor on effort, but on potential. Isn't that incredible? He would grade you according to what you were capable of doing. He admitted this. Strange man. But measuring your intellectual potential, people gradually realized, wasn't quite enough. I mean, the question arises, why is it that some people with a measured IQ of 135 don't really accomplish anything? The answer must lie in their personality. So then, in the attempt to extend and improve these techniques for measuring potential, we finally got into personality tests. Here we will measure the potential real you. We will find things out about the total you, things that even you yourself don't know. An excellent book that surveys this whole field of testing or brain watching is Martin Gross's book, The Brain Watchers. It's in paperback. It's a really good book. It's the best survey about how far this thing has gone. And you'd be surprised to read that book to find out what's being done today to you and to your husband and to your children. Diabolical things being done in the schools, in the grade schools. And that they'll give these extraordinarily probing questionnaires to little second graders, trying to find out how the parents get along. Do you ever see your parents fight? What frightens you at home? Did you ever see your daddy go to the bathroom? Questions like this. And by the way, these results, of course, are not available to parents, because parents would not know how to use them. Teachers do. You understand? All teachers are brilliant, mature, humane, self-sacrificing people with no personality problems of their own, and who would never, never be tempted to probe into little Johnny's files in order to get some information they shouldn't have and misuse that information. Actually, that would be. There are, for me, two kinds of questions that these raise, the Euclid test raise. One is questions of validity, and the other is questions of legitimacy. And though you can't completely distinguish these, I think it's useful to try to distinguish them so that we can argue where we want to be arguing. The question of validity is the question of, do the tests do what people say they do? Do they measure what people say they measure? The question of legitimacy is only raised after this. If the tests don't measure what they're supposed to measure, then we don't have to worry about legitimacy, just throw them out. But if they do, if it really is possible for somebody to make you answer 150 sentence completions and then tell you something about your personality that nobody knew before, then the tests are valid in some sense. But then we can raise the question, are they legitimate? Should we use this power even though we do have it? Validity. Are these kinds of things valid? Are they valid per se? Well, I'm afraid we have to answer yes. There's just too much evidence that competent users of competent tests can predict behavior on the basis of a personality inventory. I know one man, for example, who administers this test to every new employee of a medium-sized corporation, and he makes predictions about, for example, absenteeism and accident rate on the basis of this, and he hits. Now, that doesn't mean he hits everybody, you see, but he is likely to be able to spot from this sheet, without knowing anything else about the person, an individual who will have a high rate of absenteeism. And he so informs the personnel office, and the personnel office may not hire the guy as a result of this. So there is some validity to these tests, but you should know that many of the people who are administering them and interpreting them today are totally incompetent, and many of the tests that are being used are not valid at all. Responsible and reputable authorities in the field would insist that a majority of the tests which are being administered are not valid, either because they are tests that could not possibly measure what they claim to measure, or because they are being administered in a faulty way, or because they are being interpreted by an incompetent person. There is a great deal of gullibility about these tests. People assuming that the test can measure things that they cannot measure. Martin Gross gives the example of a businessman who said, well, he didn't have any faith in these tests. But gee whiz, everybody who said was saying they were good, and he wanted his corporation to be up with everybody else and be making use of all the new and best techniques. So he was using these. There are fraud merchants who prey upon this kind of gullibility. There are guys who didn't even finish college, running around calling, they've given themselves degrees in the psychological testing services, and they peddle their examinations to gullible administrators and personnel people. And there's a cult associated with the whole thing. One of the things, in this day and age, you know, this is the scientific age, whatever that means. But one thing it means is it's always good to go by the numbers. So if you've got to make a decision affecting the lives of people, say you're an admissions officer for a university, and you get a whole bunch of applications. You get 3,000 applications. You can only admit 1,000 students. Now, you've got to make a judgment. And that's hard. It's hard to make decisions about people's judgments. Well, if you can come up with an index number, then you don't have to decide. You're free of responsibility. Somebody says, how come you turned that guy down and you let this guy in? You can point to the number. And I think a lot of people use personality tests for this reason, to escape the responsibility of making a decision about people. Well, what about the question, though, of legitimacy? Here, I feel I can speak with more confidence. After all, I'm not a psychologist. I really have never specialized in the area of these tests, but I think as a human being, I can say something about the legitimacy of these things. Is not the growth of the cult of personality testing a part of the decline of privacy in our time? I am disturbed and frightened sometimes by what people are willing to expose about themselves, or what they're willing to talk about and to reveal to other people. When you sit down with your psychiatrist or any psychotherapist, You are dealing with him as one person to one person, and you're expecting from him help for your personal problems. Or when you go to your pastor and he counsels you, or you use the right of private confession, which never used anymore in the Lutheran Church. You are exposing yourself in a way, but you're exposing yourself to an individual in a full knowledge of what it is you are doing, and you're doing it for your own sake. You're really asking this person to aid you in the solution of your problem, to help you achieve a clearer insight. There's quite a difference between this and being willing to spill out your soul on a sheet, which will then be evaluated by a bunch of hopefully competent people, but maybe ignoramuses, and then stuck away in somebody's file somewhere and forever after used against you. And these tests do probe into all sorts of areas of your life, which I'm not saying you should be prudish or squeamish about them, but I don't think everybody has a right to know whether I have a slight homosexual tendency. My overt behavior may be a matter of public concern. If I molest children, that is a matter of public concern. If there is in my personality a slight tendency to molest children, but I've been around for 35 years and haven't molested one yet, I don't think it's anybody's business that I have this tendency. And yet this will go into your file, tendency to molest children. And of course, that's a black mark. When you could just as well say, the fact that I've got this ingrained tendency and have never exercised it, or never practiced child molestation in 35 years, seems to me that ought to speak very favorably on my behalf. But all that really counts is my inner potential. I am secretly, way down inside, a child molester. Doesn't an individual have a right in society to prove himself, and not to be judged on the basis of what he is potentially? I would like to stress the necessity in our time for relying upon objective performance. When you know something about a person's inner soul, then you may be in a position to love him more or to help him more as person to person. But I don't think you're ever, for that reason, in a position to judge him more harshly. I think you should judge people on the basis of what they do. I mean, for public purposes, people should be judged on the basis of public acts, not on the basis of some kind of probe into their inner psyches. But even more fundamentally than this, I maintain that man is inviolably and inevitably a subjective self, that there is always something about man that you can't know except by encountering him. You could listen to a complete description, as complete as you care to make it, till you run out of patience, of Roland Bainton. I could describe Roland Bainton to you. And yet, there is more to Roland Bainton than any set of observable, objective characteristics. There is something about that man that has to be encountered. You can say he does caricatures, draws caricatures, and you can go on. All this, his hair is mussed up, and you talk about the way he sort of sings eloquently at the last word in his sentences. And yet, there is more. There is in each one of us that self which is the thing that is looking at us when we examine ourselves. When we say, what is that self? It isn't even my mind, because I can think about my mind. I can talk about my mind. I can say, I have a fairly good mind, or I don't have the brains for mathematics or something like that. Now, what is it that's doing that? Well, you know, we can even take action and say, I did that. Who is talking when I say, I did that? Who is that hidden self way back there? Well, this is the thing I feel strongly that we can only know by encountering men, by talking with them. And the cult of personality testing is part of the whole attempt to define man, know him, predict and control him, without knowing him, without encountering him. And I think that there's a good constitutional protection against this sort of thing. It's the Fifth Amendment. And I would like to see us accept the idea that everybody has a right not to incriminate himself also on personality tests. You can sometimes protest effectively against the use of these. I would urge all seminary students to tell the personnel office that what they are doing is diabolical and refuse to take the test. Go to another seminary where you will also have to take a test. And at least register your protest. Now the time is up, but one question. All right.
What's wicked? Sending them to charge a plate or charge? Well, you can always tear it up. Just tear it up. You're not responsible for any use made of it. You don't even have to tear it up. You're not responsible for any use made of it as long as you've asked for it. We had a case like that down in Dallas. And some of you, I'm sure, read about it. It's a fantastic family, the Metters family. They ran up millions of dollars of those. They were the great entertainers of North Texas. And they'd done it all on money borrowed from a nunnery and credit. They were in the Neiman Marcus for something like $300,000. You know, these people, nothing in their background. Except that somebody had extended them credit. Once you get that first line of credit, you're off and rolling. If you owe Neiman Marcus $300,000, I'd be happy to lend you money. That's the attitude. That's the kind of thing. But that's kind of rare. Well, it's coffee break time. Some of you want to call.